quantum information stuff. And the second topic is quantum simulation of many body physics with R-code atoms. Let's go to the first chart, which is on linear optics. First, let's see some simple linear optics devices. We know we have a beam splitter, which basically reflects and transmits a photon, usually with a half probability. And then we have a polarization displacement, which reflects a photon when it's vertically polarized, and transmits a photon when it's horizontally polarized. So the transformation by this linear, by this kind of device are really simple. The question is whether they can never do something useful. Well, by themselves, this transformation sounds to be too trivial for any interesting application for quantum information. However, in linear optics experiments, we normally don't just use this device. We combine this device with some single-photon detectors. And we look at the coincidence from these detectors, which basically means you only select the event only when you have a photon coming out from each of these output modes. And this is the standard first selection technique. By this first selection, actually the state evolution, you only look at the state evolution in a first selected subspace. And in this subspace, the state evolution by this linear optics device becomes much more interesting. Actually, there have been a number of interesting experiments which have been done along this direction using exactly this first selection technique for demonstration of some primitive quantum information protocols. But on the other hand, there's also a problem associated with this kind of force selection. When we experiment, typically we only have a small probability to register photon from each of these detectors. And furthermore, this overall success probability, if you have n such detectors, the overall success probability will go down exponentially with the number of detectors. And this fuzzy exponential scaling limits the current demonstration technique only to a few qubits. So the main question, the main problem becomes how to make things more scalable. The most well-known approach is a linear optics quantum computation scheme, originally proposed by Neil Kaufman and Melvin here. This is our original article in 2001. So in this approach, basically one uses quantum teleportation to boost up the success probability to attain a high threshold value, then you can use quantum error correction to achieve the efficient scaling. So basically for this approach, the quantum error correction is an intrinsic element. Even if all your devices are perfect, you still need this kind of quantum error correction to achieve this efficient scaling. Over the past few years, there have been a number of works along this direction and a number of developments by different groups. One tried to improve the because for this approach, one needs to require the detector efficiency before enough quantum high efficiency detectors. So basically, one wants to improve this threshold efficiency for the quantum detectors. And until now, the best result that I knew is from the US group of this year. It's a work of this year. It basically shows threshold efficiency of 99.7%, which means if your detector has an efficiency higher than that, you can achieve efficient scaling. This is of course an important work. But on the other hand, with the current technology, it's still very hard to achieve such a high efficiency for the detectors. There's a different approach, which is not for quantum computation, but for more specific applications. It's for quantum communication, you want to communicate over a long distance, like from the long distance, it means a distance which falls beyond the photon radiation lens in optic fibers. And in this approach, basically, when I achieve the scaling by some kind of divide and conquer technique, it's also closely related to the quantum repeater architecture. And in this approach, one doesn't have any requirements on the minimum detector efficiency because it's based on different things. There's no special requirement. Basically, you can work with any low efficiency photon detectors. You can achieve scaling here. But of course, there's a price. This is for more specific applications. It's not for computation, but it's only for computation. So in these two approaches are basically complementary to each other. In this approach, I want to try to see whether we can combine some advantage from these two approaches. First, we don't want to put a stringent requirement on the photon detector efficiency, so it can work with some current for the detectors, for instance. But on the other hand, I want to extend the scope of these applications. I want to find more general protocols beyond the quantum computation. And in this talk, I want to mention two results along this direction. The first is on some result on quantum state engineering. Actually, a few years ago, we have came up with the idea how to generate the GHD type of entanglement in a scalable fashion with a new image for the detectors. And now we can extend this result. Basically, we can show with some this linear object, one can construct any ground state. And in particular, for any ground state of a tree shape, one can construct them efficiently with the fracture detectors, with any efficient detectors, you can construct them. And the second result is for quantum computation. But to do quantum computation with the low efficient photon detectors, we need something else. We need, I assume, we have some atoms. But on the other hand, I don't want to assume the strong interaction between atoms and photons, because it's still very hard to achieve strong coupling between atoms and photons. So instead, I just use some weak interaction between atoms. I basically use free split atoms, which only has a very weak coupling to photons. And because of this weak coupling, you only have some probabilistic type of operations. And with this, we will see that this probabilistic type of operations are actually enough for our purpose. And we want to use a new efficient photon detectors. The price for that is we need to assume the atom detectors for the much higher efficiency. So we have high efficient atom detectors. And in some sense, this is something that is realistic because we know now the photon detector efficiency is taken about 80%. And for atom detectors, it's routine now to get a efficiency of about 99 or even 99.9%. So here I will mainly spend some time to explain this protocol and I'll quickly mention some results along this direction. There are some experiments there are also some experiments along that direction. So fortunately clarify was a resource we assume for this approach. We have some input states. This is basically some imperfect photon phase with a large probability you get a vacuum basically from nothing, and with a small probability you get a pair of photons which are entangled in the polarization basis, and we just call this eta s here as the source efficiency, the probability to get this photon pair, and we know this is a typical state which is generated from the Fermi experiments like the spontaneous meltdown conversion. When you apply a Fermi pulse with a type 2 configuration, you get this type of state. And this state can also be generated from some other physical device, some physical setups. For instance, if you have an atomic sample, a sample of atomic gas, then if you apply a punching laser and a refarming laser beams, you will also get this in 10 photon pairs. And the difference here is you can delete the application of this refarming laser pair, so you can store these photons in this atomic sample for some time before you release these photons. So basically, it can combine. It can combine it with the quantum memory and introduce some controllable delay here. And the other possibility, you can also do this with the trapped ions, with like all single trapped atoms. You also apply Fermi and Fermi pulse. And this is kind of similar to this one, but the soft probability is even lower here, because here, for many atoms, there are some clanking effects which enhance the probability. Here, so you have an even lower probability. But the good thing here is that this trapped ion is a perfect quantum memory. You can store the information there for a very long time. So this is our source. We only have this imperfect photon pairs. So how to generate some more complex state or more cool state from this source? Well, for that purpose, you typically want just import a photon from each of these pairs to some polarization in spinetum. But different from some current experiments, we don't assume we immediately put a photon detector here. If you put a photon detector here, basically you destroy these photons, and it's hard to build a more complex structure. So instead, here we arrange our settlements or arrange our photon detections in such a way that our final photon detection will still first snatch the parallel space with one photon on each mode, even we don't put a photon detector immediately here. So in some sense, you can imagine there's a virtual photon detection which helps you to do this first selection. So we still only need to look at the state evolution in a post-selected subspace. And in this post-selected subspace, this PBS actually performs a kind of quantum gate operation. This operation corresponds to by this projector. This projector means only when both of the incoming photons are horizontally polarized or both of them are vertically polarized, you stay in this subspace, otherwise you go out. If you have one edge polarized, one wave polarized, one of them will go through, one of them will be reflected, and then both of the photons go to the same side, and you go outside of this subspace. So within this subspace, basically we apply this kind of projector, and we want to show here this projector is enough for everything. It's basically enough for everything. With that, you can construct any space. And to show that, basically we show first how to construct the graph state. The graph state is a useful resource for quantum information, including the quantum computation, the concept proposed by as shown by Hans Rapp and Hans Rieger a few years ago. With that, you can do quantum computation as well as some other quantum information protocols. So now we want to show how to achieve such a state with this kind of polarization in splitter. For that purpose, I just combine this PBS with a hardware plate, and we just call this a combination as a PBS gate. And if you apply such a combination along two photons, you have two imperfect photon pairs, 1, 2, and 3, 4. Each is described by some state before, as we shown before. If you apply this combination on this 2 and 3 photons, and you look at the evolution in this, look at the state in this first next subspace, you basically get this 4-qubit graph state. And you can certainly continue with this process. If you apply these two stable states, then basically this one will be connected to this one, and this one is connected to this one. So you basically get this stable state. And with a little bit of practice, one can easily convince oneself that with the continued application of these operations, you can construct any graph state of phase. And actually, you can do more than that. You can also combine these three stable states, and what you get is a loop. You get a kind of loop operations. And then you can continue with that. You basically can construct any two-dimensional graphs or any more, or any other graphs. So with that, one indeed can construct any graph states. But the problem is that whether this is scalable, whether you have an efficient scaling here. Well, because here we still need to do final photon detection. Here we need to assume each of the photons will be finally detected by some photon detectors. And there are still final efficient issues. So we still have some exponential scaling. We have still have some exponential scaling here. So in the following, I want to show you a more efficient construction method, which can improve the scaling from this exponential one to something which is almost polynomial. So to show this more efficient construction method, this is actually basically what for graph state of a tree sheet. I first want to mention or to emphasize that for any graph state, for any preparation of graph states, our final motivation is always for some applications. We may use these graph states for demonstration of many-body entanglement, or use them for demonstration of quantum nanomechanics, or use them for some quantum computation. So for any of these applications, you need to do some measurements at the end. And normally these measurements can be done by some single photon, by some detection of the single photons. So I just call these measurements as application measurements. And to get a more efficient scaling method, I just want to do these application measurements as early as possible. And if you do some measurements and you find something which go outside of your desired subspace, you can repeat as early as possible, and this gives you the more efficient scaling. To show this idea, let's first look at the 4-qubits. If I want to construct a graph state from this 2-entangled photon pair, basically we want to do the connection of these two. What are we doing here? The PBS gate only needs to apply on this photon 2 and photon 3. We do nothing on this qubit 1 and qubit 4. So that reminds us we can immediately apply the application measurements on this 1 and 4 qubits already. So actually, before this connection, we can do this application measurements now. And for this application measurements, either you register photon counts or you get nothing. And if you get nothing, basically it's a correspond to a failure event. And in this case, you are sure that you go outside, you have been outside of your physical subspace. So in this case, it doesn't make any sense to do this connection anymore, and you just need to restart over. And this actually saves you a lot of times. So early when you read the photon from both of these one, from this qubit one and the qubit four, you continue with this step of connection. So early when you succeed, you do this connection, then you basically get this shape of space. It's a kind of vertical solution. But these two actually have been mirrored already, but it doesn't matter. The entanglement is here represented by this structure. Then you for the next step, you only require this top qubit for the connection. So you can similarly you can immediately apply the measurement on this middle qubit. And then you do the next step of connection and you go on and go on. So one can see here, for this kind of protocol, most of them could be going to be mirrored already, even before you finish your construction of the whole space. And that actually saves you a lot of time and it gives you a substantial difference in the scaling. And one can work out the scaling for this kind of preparation method. And one can show that the two-dot preparation time, you can use the two-dot preparation time to characterize such a scaling. The two-dot preparation time is basically given by this formula. This is not the best time unit. It's a if you consider the SGBC experiments, spontaneous parametric down converting experiments, this T naught is basically the pulse duration for this Hamming pulse. That's a times you get an imperfect photon pair, and which is typically shown in experiments about a few nanoseconds. And then this is the source efficiency. Remember, from each Hamming pulse, we only have a small probability to get a photon pair, and that source efficiency goes here. And this eta d is the detector efficiency for all the detections. For the detections, you have this efficiency. And this n is the number of qubits in your final graphs. And one can see here, this two-dot time qubits at the n log n. And because of this log factor here, this for practical purpose, this is almost like a prolonged scaling. It's much slower than an experimental scaling. And also, this scaling only has a weak dependence on the photon detector efficiency. So also due to this log function very sensitive to that. And to see the difference between this scaling and the scaling in the direct preparation method, I can give you just a simple example. For instance, if you want to prepare a graph state of 32 qubits, and you take a source efficient about 1% and the detector efficient about 33%, this detector efficient can also include some other kind of photon loss and photon the efficiencies. I think this is a kind of realistic number. And then you basically get this time over this time unit about 10 to 7. Given this T0 is pretty short, it's still a reasonable time. And if you do a direct preparation method, then you have typical experimental scaling. It gives you the eta s and eta d by this experimental scaling. And you can easily see this, you basically get a terrible number. It's a number, it's a time longer than the universe. So even for this simple example, which doesn't have many qubits, the difference between this scaling and the experimental scaling is kind of dramatic. So that basically shows how to get the graph states with some photon detectors by using this kind of technique. In the following, I will use a few minutes to briefly summarize some results on the probabilistic quantum computation with the atom photon coupling. A couple of years ago, we came up with the idea how to generate entanglement, technically a probabilistic entanglement, between a single pair of ions and a single photon. For that experiment, basically, one started with this kind of network configuration. One put a photon in one of these ground states, and then put this atom up. With a little pulse, then you just wait for this atom to decay back. There are two atomic decay channels. Each one gives this decay gives a spontaneous emission photon, and this photon is either horizontally polarized or vertically polarized, which gives you and the final state also different. Now, if you detect this spontaneous emission photon along a small solid angle, you collect this photon within a small solid angle, you put a photon detector here. Then I can easily see that the horizontal and vertical polarization of the photons will get correlated with the final atomic state, say, spin down state. So you basically get this type of state, and it's, you actually have a coherence between these two components. And that's, you know, this is a perfect interactive. And this kind of entanglement has been confirmed by the Chris Morris group a couple years ago. And actually, that's the first time to show the entanglement between the atoms and the photons with this. So it's a kind of entanglement between applying to these kind of quantum memory. Now we can do something better than these entangling schemes. One can do a quantum gate now on the atoms and the photons. So what I need to emphasize, or I need to mention, remind you, the difference between a gate operation and an entangling protocol. For this entangling protocol here, basically we have a fixed final state. No matter what the initial state, you get a fixed final state. So you don't keep track of the initial state information. But for gate operation, we know it's critical to keep track of the initial state information. And that's crucial for doing quantum computation. With the entangled state, exactly, you cannot go up. So basically, we assume we initially start with a state which have a stable position of these two. And here, we also use a different, slightly different level configuration. We assume the qubit is represented by these two states. These two states are normally called the clock states because these are the stable states which are used in atomic clocks. Then you apply a short laser pulse on these ions. This is a short and ultra-fast laser pulse. It has a bandwidth which covers both of these hyperfine states. And then these ions will be pushed to the up phase. And the key point here is there are some good selection rules. There are some atomic transition selection rules. So this state, this down state, this up state can only go to the lower level, and this down state only go to the up level. Otherwise, you get a mixture between these two. Everything is destroyed. So there's a selection rule which keeps this one-to-one correlation. And then you just decay. You just net the ion, decay back to its ground state. There are actually several decay channels. First, let's look at the decay channel, which gives this vertical decay channel, which basically gives a photon, which is a high polarized photon. And you can fill all the decay channels. Just put a polarizer here, which is this sigma plus sigma minus polarized. You can kick out that kind of photons. So you only keep these pi decay channels. And for these photons in these pi decay channels, they have the same polarization, but they have some different colors or different frequency. So we just call one of them the blue photon, one of them the red photon. You don't need different little bit in color. And you can see here, this spin off will correlate with the blue photon, the spin down will be correlated with the red photon. And also, this initial state information, see not as see why it's still kept here. So, after this, it's actually corresponds to a kind of gate operation between this atom and this spontaneous emission photon. And this kind of, there are some initial experiments on this approach already. And this kind of operation can lead to more gates, need to gate on remote ions. If you, now if I assume with a following with a box setup, now I put two ions, one ion here, one ion there, they can be pretty far away. And then you excite each ion with a little pulse with the same number configuration. You have two spontaneous emission photons now, one from here, one from there. You bring these two photons to interfere them at a beam splitter and detect them by choosing a photon detectors. And when you have a coincidence, you can count here, count here. Then one can show this kind of operation basically projects the ion states, these two ion states, in the subspace spanned by the 0, 1, 1, 0 states. And we just call this a promiscuous leading gate because it corresponds to a measurement of the sigma d operator. And actually, this kind of gate is all we need for quantum computation. If you have this kind of gate, even if you can only succeed with a very small probability, in current experiments, the success probability is pretty small, it's 10 to minus 6 or something like that. So, but even with that, in principle, we can still need to efficient quantum computation. And there's so why is that? So normally if you have a probabilistic gate, if you have a gate, entangling gate, which only succeeds with a probability P, and then for quantum computation, you need to use many such gates. If you need to use N gates, then the overall success probability we are given by P to N. That will be exponentially small, and you have problems in scaling. But one of our recent results is to show, exactly a result done in collaboration with Dr. Dorf. one can do much better than this naive algorithm. One can prove that the efficient quantum computing is possible, no matter how small this success probability is. So as long as this key is larger than zero, or in another word, you can see the error probability here, which is given by 1 minus t, is smaller than 100%. You can get efficient quantum computation. So for this particular noise, for this particular error, the error threshold detection can be up to 100%. And one can further prove that compared with the deterministic gate, the additional combination of overheads here only scales polynomially, both with the size of the computation, this n means the size of the computation, the number of qubits, and also with the 1 minus t or 1 over t here. Because this t is a small number, this 1 over t can be large number. So it's also important to have a polynomial scaling with this quantity. The proof of this result is not straightforward. So here I will just skim the details. I don't want to go into too much details. The basic idea we need to first construct some graph space based on this kind of probabilistic gates. And then we need some different ideas to prepare one-dimensional graph space and a two-dimensional graph space. And only 2D graph space are universal for quantum computation. And for 1D space, basically when you use some divided Kronecker scheme, and for 2D space, there are some different ideas to generate efficient connection. And one can work out the final scheme for this approach. One can show that the tutor times to construct a large scale graph with this probabilistic gate only scales with the size of the computation by n log n formula. So it's very close to a linear scaling, and it scales with this y over p by this kind of function. It's almost a polynomial function here. So that's a result for this kind of probabilistic approach. It basically provides a motivation for the Kronecker experiments, because in Kronecker experiments, this success probability is indeed small, and the error is indeed close to 100%. So as a brief summary for the fourth part of my talk, I basically show that a single polarization distributor can work at a powerful gate in the first vector subspace. And with that gate, you can construct any graph space. And in particular, for any graph space over tree shape, you can construct them efficiently, even if you have a very low efficient photon detectors with some correct photon detectors. And for the quantum computation, basically, we show that there's some physical mechanisms which we can design from this gate over the remote ions without any cavities. And we can show with this from this gate, one can still need to efficient quantum computation. So that's the first part of my talk. Any question for that? Okay, yeah.
Can you go back to the input state? So, do you consider the high order terms? I mean, like you imagine you have more than one pairs.
Yeah, that's given by S square. So this higher term is actually not a problem for generation of this graph state, this tree graph state, because one can find actually if you do the first connection, this higher term will not give a contribution. There's some subtleties here. If you have a loops, this higher terms actually you need to consider this higher terms. But if you have a tree state, the higher terms will automatically eliminate by the final photon detection.
How do we see that?
This is a little bit tricky. So probably I can explain you for 4 qubits. If you have this configuration, you are combining this and you do photon detect here, and you want to do photon detect here. If you have 2 photon pairs here, you will never get a count on here. That's why this two pair amplitude is automatically eliminated. So for any this kind of capacitor tree shape, for any this connection, you have no problems. But if you also put a photon detector, you bring these 2 photons together, and you put a detector here, this basically forms a loop. And in that case, when you consider the 2 photon keys, 2 photon pairs. Because in that case, if you have 2 photon pairs here, it's indistinguishable from 1 pair here, 1 pair here.
And this kind of main reason why you can only work with the tree graph space?
only for the, one can construct any graph state, but only for the p-graph states, you can construct them with the efficient scheme, even for any, even for no efficient photon detectors. The reason is, the basic reason is, for any tree, you can divide them, for any tree structure, you can always divide them into two parts, to almost equal parts with one cut. And if you have a two-dimensional structure, if you want to cut them into two equal parts, the number of cuts will goose up with the number of qubits. And that makes the essential difference when you use this protocol. So basically, I need to assume you have a constant number of cuts when you divide this when you divide this structure into two parts.
And how useful are these tree graph states?
How useful are these tree graph states? Okay, this p-graph, first, this p-graph state cannot be used for quantum computation. We just have a visual result which shows for any computation, for any unitary evolution, single bit unitary evolution on the p-graphs, it can be simulated by a classical computer. Mm-hmm. So they are not used for quantum computation, but they certainly can be used for demonstration of some quantum mechanics or some demonstration of some quantum communication protocols. If you have multiple, where you have multiple sites, you can do some quantum communication stuff with that. Yeah.
You showed some kind of hexagonal ring loop, so when you connect three little trees, I think.
Yeah.
But that's big enough a loop that.
Yeah, that's a loop. Yeah, that's true. You mean that's a? I just show you in principle with this PBS operation, you can get loops, but if you have low efficient photon detectors. You cannot generate it with the efficient scheme. There's no problem. You can generate any state with this operation, but the scheme is not efficient if you can move photon detectors. Okay.
Can you go back to the probabilistic states on the remote qubits or something?
Which one?
This one. So how do you synchronize your detector? It seems to be synchronization to the big problem.
What you need to synchronize is the synchronize of these two quantum pulses. But I think that's a major technology. You can just apply two quantum pulses, you bring two quantum together for interference. And that you can be, it can be done pretty well now.
So the lifetime of excited states is short enough that they
decay
at the same time.
Yeah, they decay because the decay times, well, the lifetime for this up state are about 11 seconds. So you can open it up there. So if there are no other questions, I go to the second part of my talk, which is on quantum simulation. I guess for the quantum information coming here, this term quantum simulation is familiar. But here I want to put this term in a more general context. If we go beyond the quantum simulation, we want to show how quantum, so we go beyond quantum information, we want to show how the quantum simulation, quantum simulation relates to the general structure of physics. We know based on the physics, or in principle, and we can also say you know, the whole size, basically consists of a hierarchy of effective theories at different levels. For instance, from the bottom up, you have a standard model of particle physics, and from there, you build, basically, you build nuclear theory, and then from there, you build atomic theory, and then from that, you build a condensed matter theory, and et cetera. So it's a hierarchy of different theories and different effective theories at different levels. And if we just look at this hierarchy at a certain level, we can just call this a lower level theory as a fundamental one, and the upper level theory as an effective one. And typically from this fundamental theory goes up to this effective theory, there are some new organization principles. So that means with the same fundamental theory under different configurations, you may get different effective theories. And similarly, the same effective theory can also arise from different systems with different fundamental theories. So there's no one-to-one correspondence between these two. For quantum simulation, basically we want to use one fixed quantum system to simulate all the systems. So you have one system with a fixed fundamental theory. But the basic idea here is that you try to introduce different control configurations. So under different configurations, you can design and you can get different effective theories. And this effective theory may be associated, or maybe related to some condensed systems, or maybe related with some nuclear theory, or even related to some particle physics. So with this kind of ability, you can start inventing different kinds of theories, physical theories, at one experimental systems. And you can do a paper pop experiments for all the theories at different levels. And that's basically the merit of quantum simulation at the first emphasized by Feynman. And one can also see here, to realize this kind of idea of quantum simulation, the key requirement is the controllability. You need this controllability to get different effective theories and with under different configurations. So we need to have a system which have enough controllability. And what we have in mind for realization of this quantum simulation is a system of R-code atoms. So this R-code here means it's really close. The film temperature is talking about a few tens of nanokelvin. Actually, this corresponds to the coldest place in the universe. You can never find the temperature which is as low as this one. And this actually shows that what is the condensate. It's a picture which gives a Nobel Prize. So, and for R-cooled atoms, we can either use this Bose-Einstein condensate or use some R-cooled formulas, or even their mixtures. All this has been realized now in current experiments. So why it's good for this system? Because this system has some remarkable controllability. And some people call this system a quantum material. It's a kind of material you can well control its quantum properties and can be used to simulate all the other materials. And we have a number of ways to control the configuration for the systems. For instance, you can put these R-cooled atoms into an optical lattice. And by controlling the interference patterns of these laser beams, you can design various geometry of these optical lattice. And you can also get some optical field lattice. And secondly, for these systems, you have both boson and fermionic atoms. They have different statistics. And for each species of atoms, you also have different internal atomic states, which basically give you a different spin degree of freedom. So you can also study the spin dynamics. And certainly for these systems, the interaction strength between the atoms can be well controlled. Later, we will show some method to control that. It's a so-called feedback resonance technique, which is now widely used in many experimental groups. And finally, we can also study the dynamic properties, as well as some equilibrium properties for this system. So here I want to illustrate this kind of remarkable controllability with some few examples. For instance, one can introduce or one can simulate some spin-dependent gauge fields for these systems, and then with that one can study the so-called Spin-Hall effects for these systems. And the Spin-Hall effect is a very important topic for the spintronics in the spintronics community. And we can also use them to simulate some quantum magnetics, to simulate some quantum magnetic models. And one can realize some exotic models. One example for that is a model proposed by Kadayev, which supports aliens. One can also use that to simulate some counter type of physics. This counter physics means it's kind of physics we need to kind of material, it's called California material. This material can come filtered via Earth atoms. And the physics is one branch of surrounding coordinate physics. And finally, you can also use that to simulate some physics, which is closely related to the so-called TGA model and the RVD type of physics. This RVD means the relative valence bond. It's a concept which was first proposed by Phil Anderson. It's one of the key concepts in the community of kinetic system connectivity. So in this talk, I cannot use all of this, but I just want to mention some results for the second example and the third and this last example. The second, for both of these examples, we will use some optical lattice to control these atoms. So first, let me quickly mention the basic idea of optical lattice. So if you have atoms, if you have two random levels, and you apply laser beam to these atoms, if you have a logic tuning, you know the atoms cannot make a real transfer. But due to the second order perturbation, we all knew that the energy of this lower level will be shifted. And this energy shift will be proportional to the intensity of this applied laser. So if you apply a setting with laser, the intensity will vary in space by this periodic form. Then the eta at this level will see a periodic energy shift that basically gives a periodic potential. And at low temperature, the eta will sit at the bottom of these potentials. And in this way, you basically get a kind of periodic lattice, it's a perfect lattice. And this optical lattice was the first used to control atoms in 2002 by the Hans Bloch group. So one of the most famous people in the optical atom community. And by that, one observes the stable fluid motion meter conditions for the first time. So now I want to show how with this optical lattice, how one can get some to get some quantum magnetic models. This is actually an old work. I mentioned that just because this is had a little bit of relation with the topological transmutation. You can get some anions from this model. For that purpose, you can see that spin half atoms in the lattice. Spin half means these atoms have two internal components. They have different spin states. And you have spin up, spin down, you have both. You are in the multi-meter region, which means you have one atom per side. Then you control your laser so that the laser intensity is different for these spin up and spin down atoms. And that can be achieved by the selection rules so that the laser intensity is different for these two conditions. So in this configuration, you can see the spin up atoms will see a low potential barrier, and the spin down atoms will see a much higher potential barrier. And we know the boundary ridge between these neighboring atoms will be very sensitive to the barrier. We all know this vertical boundary is sensitive to barrier. And because if you have this spin-dependent barrier, you will get some spin-dependent colony. And with this spin-dependent colony, we can realize some interesting quantum magnetic model. We can derive the effect Hamiltonian for these systems. And it turns out this effect Hamiltonian has this form. This sigma XYZ is just a normal quantum matrix. For each atom with two components, we can describe them by this quantum matrix. And this submitted over all the nearest neighbors, all the nearest neighbor atom spins are integrated through this kind of Hamiltonian. And this Hamiltonian is actually a well-known Hamiltonian in many body physics. It's called the XFC model, and it's the fundamental model for description of quantum magnetism. And for the atomic realization of this model, we can note here that both of these two coefficients here, can be well controlled. They can be controlled by just tuning this laser intensity. And you can control the magnitude and the phase and even orbital size that actually give you a bunch of quantum phase transitions. In principle, you can study the quantum phase transition associated with these quantum magnetic models. And furthermore, you can realize more exotic magnetic coupling. For instance, you can realize different magnetic coupling along different spatial directions in the lattice. You know, in the lattice for these neighboring atoms, they can be arranged along different directions. One can get different type of directions. Coupling along these different directions. The example for that is this cadaic model, this model which is kind of exactly solvable and has an anterior ground state and excitation properties. It's a model proposed by cadaic a couple years ago. And for this model, you have a hexagon lattice, and you have spin half particles sit on this lattice. And then the spin, the interaction for any two spins along this direction, they are interacting through this XX coupling, and then on this direction they are interacting through the YY, and then on the vertical direction through the ZZ coupling. And this Hamiltonian turns out to be exactly solvable, and it has two types of phases. Depending on the ratio of these three parameters, it has a central phase which has supports non-abelian anions, and it has an edge phase which supports this abelian anion excitations. So this model indeed has interesting properties. But on the other hand, this model looks to be pretty artificial, and it's impossible to find some condensed matter material which has this kind of coupling. But for these atomic systems, it provides the opportunity to realize such a model. Of course, the realization is not easy. There are some details here. I will skip this detail, and I just want to mention there are three basic steps to realize such a model. First, we need to form the two-dimensional hexagon lattice, and that can be achieved by some three laser beams interfering in the right direction. And then we need to introduce some spin-dependent colony here, and in the above, I will show some idea to get this spin-dependent colony. And from that, you can get the FX model. If you remember, you get the FX model. And as a particular case for this, you can get the ZZ company. So basically, there's no problem to get the ZZ company and all these working directions. But the last point is how to get the different magnetic components in all these different directions. And the idea there is basically we define or we change the quantization axis for these atoms. So that's the easy work that kind of startup atomic physics. But the basic result is that if you have a quantization axis Z and on this direction, you will have a quantization axis X and on this direction. Then if you have ZZ coming here, you will automatically have XX coming here, and similarly you can get a YY coming in along other direction. So that indeed provides the probability to exactly realize this model, and this is just a basic idea for details. One can look at this work. This shows by this example, I just want to show you in this operative, you can indeed get some interesting interaction configurations. You can get a pretty diverse interaction configuration there. But there's one problem with this operative. It's like this model is still pretty hard to realize. The reason for that is for any atoms in an operative, the interaction is pretty weak. The interaction is weak because it's suppressed by this potential barrier. So that means if you want to observe some phenomena, you need to require a very low temperature. So even if you have a cooling place in the universe, you can still hard to get such a so temperature is not low enough for that. So that's one of the obstacles to current experiments. But on the other hand, the other way to overcome this problem is basically through this physical random technique. Here the interaction is weak, but there's a method which can dramatically increase the interaction magnitude for these atoms. And that's the idea of feedback resonance. This figure shows the basic idea of the feedback resonance. It comes from the collision physics of the atoms. So when two atoms, they collide with each other, they are interacting with each other. Basically, we know from quantum mechanics, the real potential between any two atoms is this kind of negative potential. At a far distance, they are interacting through this kind of Wallace force, and you have some continuum level here. And at a short distance, you have some attractive interaction which gives you the quasi-bound states, the molecular levels. And in the collision language, we call this open channel, this closed channel, and there's some common between these two channels. But right now, you can apply an external magnetic field, and these two channels, the atoms in these two channels will have different spin configurations. So they have different response to this magnetic field. So by tuning this magnetic field, you can tune the energy difference between the atoms in these two channels. And then you can achieve a resonance between these two. And due to this resonance coupling, the effect becomes dramatically enhanced. And that resonance is exactly called the feedback resonance. And by that resonance, the effective interaction of the atoms can be increased a lot. This shows the typical experimental data for the interaction magnitude between the atoms. That can be characterized by the so-called scalariness. And you can see here, if you tune the magnetic field to this resonance point, the scalariness basically goes to infinity, which signals a very strong interaction. This is data which shows from the MIT group, which shows first this kind of shows this kind of technique for the first time. So with this feedback resonance, you have a powerful method to control the interaction magnitude. So now we have two most powerful control methods for the cooled atoms. One is optogenetic, which can give you diverse interaction configurations always for controlling interaction magnitude. And it's natural to consider a combination of these two. And indeed, there are several experimental groups that are working in this direction. And with this through this feedback resonance, you have strong interacting atoms. And then now you have strong interacting atoms in an optical lattice. And our purpose here is that we want to understand these systems, these strong interacting systems. And for direct understanding, we need to write down a combinatorial for these systems. And actually, you can see here, this Hamiltonian is actually it's pretty difficult to derive such a Hamiltonian due to the strong interaction here. And basically, I show you a method to derive this effect Hamiltonian and how this Hamiltonian is connected to some interesting many body physics. So why is it hard to write down the Hamiltonian for these systems? Well, there are two problems. One is super the multiple M combinations. This is such a strong interacting system so that the atom interactions on each side it's much stronger than the energy scale for this optical lattice. You know, in an optical lattice, in a periodic potential, you will have band structure, you have band gap, but you have the interactor which is larger than the band gap. So even at a zero temperature, a significant fraction of atoms will go to the upper band of the optical lattice. So you have many band configurations. In principle, you need to consider atom in a band R, couple to atom in a band Q, and then become molecule in a band P, and then you have this summation of all the probabilities. And the second problem here is so also due to the strong interaction, you need to consider the collisions between the nearest neighbors. You cannot just consider the on-site interactions. The atoms from here can interact with the atom here and form the molecule here. And this interaction turns out to be larger than the atom boundary. So you need to consider that for any multiple wheel problems. So with these two complexities, you can still try to derive the Hamiltonian, but it just gives you a terrible expression. This is object Hamiltonian. I don't want to explain it, but I just want to mention here, you have summations over all these different bands, and you have summations over all these different sides, this neighboring size. So you have a communication interaction. And if you have such a Hamiltonian, it's basically equivalent to solve these systems. So our main problem becomes how to simplify this Hamiltonian to build some effective theory which can give a good understanding of this system. And the basic idea for this simplification comes from the separation of different energy scales. So basically, you need to try to identify different energy scales in these systems. And we find there are several energy scales, like this on-site interaction, the band gap, the off-site interaction, the atom boundary. And you can find these energy scales simplify these good relations. And there are some exponential recognitions, which indeed shows this condition is satisfied. So with such a condition, we can consider the on-site interaction of the much larger than the off-site interaction. This is the dominant one. So first we need to look at the physics from the dominant interaction and then take the other interactions into account. So from the dominant interaction, you have a single side problem. You exactly solve side problems. It still involves some technique, but if I can solve that. And from this dominant interaction, you build some effective degree of freedom to some quasi-particles. And in this case, we call these quasi-particles as address atoms and address molecules. Then you take into account the other interactions and derive some effective Hamiltonian for these quasi-particles. And that's our basic approach. The mathematical techniques here is based on some projection method and based on the Kalanick transformations. I will skip that. I will just write down the final effect Hamiltonian for our quasi particles. And this is the final effect Hamiltonian. If you compare with our previous one, this one looks much nicer. And this first term shows this stress molecules on every side with the energy which can be controlled by the magnetic field. Then you have this stress molecule colony. You have a project here, which means you cannot put two stress molecules on the same side because there are some energy costs there. And then you have the atom colony, you have a linear colony term here, which corresponds to this configuration. If you have one just molecule here, one atom here, if one moves to this side, it corresponds to this kind of interactions. The last term is an association and a dissociation term for these stress molecules. It's actually one of the most important terms for this Hamiltonian. It corresponds to these two atoms, become the spin signature state for the atoms on different sides. And this spin signature is actually closely related to this event bound concept. This Hamiltonian this Hamiltonian can be related to some well-known many body Hamiltonians. To see this Hamiltonian supports some interesting physics, we can just look at this Hamiltonian into different limits. In one limit, we tune up the energy for the stress molecules. So now the energy of these stress molecules goes up, and most of the formulation should be in these atoms. Then you can adiabatically eliminate the stress molecules and derive an effect Hamiltonian for these atoms. And this turns out to be the effect Hamiltonian. You have the atoms which can tunnel over the nearest neighbors, and you have three of these atoms which are interacting through this catabolic interaction. And this Hamiltonian is super the TGA model. If you are familiar with many body physics, this is one of the most fundamental Hamiltonian for many body physics. And this Hamiltonian is closely related to this famous phase diagrams for the high TC semiconductors. You have the anti-ferromagnetic phase, you have the D-wave semiconducting phase, And if you do some diffuse type of termination of this model, it kind of finds this kind of things. But of course, there are a lot of debates now on whether this function looks simple, but you still cannot solve it exactly. That's the main problem here. From there, there's still a lot of debate on this kind of Hamiltonians. So with this ensemble realization, it gives you an opportunity to really study this Hamiltonian in experiments. And furthermore, you can well control these parameters in experiments. That's one of the merits of the idea of quantum simulation. There's one limiting case. We give some interesting Hamiltonians. One can also consider other limits. So opposite limiting case, if you tune down the energy for these stress molecules, then all your combination should be in the best molecules. The atoms can be adversely eliminated. And you arrive at effect Hamiltonian for these stress molecules. And as it turns out, this effect Hamiltonian is against the XXC model. Why is the XXC model? So now you have a best molecule on each side. You either have one best molecule or zero best molecule. So it becomes an effective two-level system. And if you work out the details for these two-level systems, it turns out the interaction can be always described by this polytype, the interaction between these polymetrics. So you again get this kind of model. And for this FXC model, we know it's a mean field phase diagrams. It has some intermediate stage. It's called the checkerboard phase, where you have one best molecule on every other side of this best molecule. That molecule cannot move due to some nearest neighbor interactions. And then you have a single fluid phase here, where the best molecule can move around the lattice and form the single fluid. And you have some mode state, which you have one best molecule on every side. So this gives you the mean field type of phase diagrams. And in a very recent experiment, the MIT group, the Kent groups, can observe some of the first evidence of the simple fluidity for strongly interacting fermions in the optical lattice. That's actually a very important experiment. It really gives the realistic hope now to understand this high PC type of physics from these atomic systems. So, lastly, just a brief summary. I quickly mentioned some idea for simulation of many body physics with cooled atoms. And I just give you two examples for simulation of quantum magnetism and for simulation of and for strongly interacting fermions in the optical lattice, where you get some physics which is close to the high TC field. Let's stop there. Thank you for your attention.
Your purpose then transparency, when we're talking about split grid and not phases, what is the observable that you really look at when you do your simulation?
How you observe that? That's a good question. I don't talk about the technique here. So right now the observation method is called the time of flight imaging. You just expand your time clock shown by this picture, and then you detect the final density distribution. And one can show by this observation, you basically detect some correlation functions. And from these correlation functions, you can see the signal of stable fluid. Basically, for stable fluid phase, where the atoms on this different, we have different lattice size. These atoms on this different lattice size have some coherence. And you will see some interference peaks, and that give you a stable fluid, that give you evidence for stable fluidity. There's a phase coherence between different sizes, which is connected with the currency, and the currency is responsible for the fluidity.
So how useful is the simulation? How big a system you can simulate, and how
well? Yeah, that's an exact point. So this is a large system. So you can consider this as the first practical application of idea of quantum simulation. The typical atom number is 10 to 6. So you certainly cannot solve that picture with a classical computer. And that's why we need some input from experiments to help identify what's the problem, what's the properties of this system. It's a system which is very hard to understand now. You have 10 to 6 particles, and then you have strong interactions. So actually, that's very tricky.
So you're saying in the physical system, there's 10 to the 6 particles. But when you do this simulation, how many do you need?
For this simulation, actually you don't, you know, it's a, It's a for, I think normally when you have 10 to 6, of course the real system, like the real material, they have 10 to 23 particles. But for 10 to 6 atoms, the physics would be very close to the 10 to 30, 10 to 23 particles, because it's called the thermodynamic limit. When you go to 10 to 6, the error goes like 1 over air, something like that. And so of course you need to be air, so this air to be very large. So error is just here, so that 1 over m, there's some dynamic limit. So what's the exact air requirement on the atom number? There's no definite boundary for this, but certainly air needs to be much larger than one to suppress the errors from the thermodynamic. So that's my name. I guess people wouldn't record it as a stable fluid if you have if you only have six particles. But it's a.
And my question is, if I have six, what would I see in my correlation function?
Yeah, you can certainly see the correlation function, and you may identify some. The concept of stable fluid is only defined when you have a thermodynamic limit. Thermodynamic limit means n tends to infinity. And the error, any real systems wouldn't have n tends to infinity. But if you n much larger than one, the physics gets very close, because the y over n becomes very small. But if you have y over six, the finite size effect is very significant. So of course, many people do the classical simulations, do the numerical many body physics to solve, try to understand these systems. What they can do now is they can do some particle number, like the largest particle, maybe 20 or 20 particles. So with 20 particles, you can run this model on your computer, you can find what the physics, and you do some finite size screening. So with the quantum simulation, I think if you want to go beyond the current class computer, it's better that you have something which cannot be simulated on class computer. So that means probably you need to go beyond like 20 particles. Otherwise, you know what you expect.
Any further questions? Well, thanks, speaker again.